Chapter 33. The whorehouse had closed hours ago. Upstairs, the girl slept on fouled sheets amid the brothel smells of stale alcohol, stale sweat, old sex, wood smoke, and cheap perfume. The doors were locked. All but two of the plain copper lamps downstairs had been extinguished. Mama Kay didn't allow her brothels to waste money. There were only two people downstairs, both of them at the bar. Around the man's seat were the remains of a dozen smashed glasses. He finished the 13th beer, lifted the glass, and threw it onto the floor. It shattered. Mama Kay poured Durzo another beer from the tap, not even blinking. She didn't say a word. Durzo would speak when he was ready. Still, she wondered why he'd chosen this brothel. It was a hole. She sent her attractive girls elsewhere. Other brothels she'd bought had been worth fixing, but this one huddled deep in the Warrens, far from main roads in the maze of shacks and hovels. This was where she'd lost her maidenhead. She'd been paid 10 silvers, and had counted herself lucky. It wasn't high on her list of places to visit. "I should kill you," Durzo said finally. They were the first words he'd spoken in 6 hours. He finished his beer and shoved it along the bar. It slid several feet, fell over, rolled off the bar, and cracked.
"Oh, so you do have the power of speech?"
Mama Kay said. She grabbed another glass and opened the tap.
"Do I have a daughter, too?"
Mama Kay froze. She closed the tap too late, and beer spilled all over.
"Vonda made me swear not to tell you. She was too scared to tell you, and then, when she died... You can hate Vonda for what she did, Durzo, but she did it because she loved you."
Durzo gave her a look of such disbelief and disgust that Guinevere wanted to hit his ugly face.
"What do you know about love, you whore?"
She had thought that no one could hurt her with words. She'd heard every whore comment in the book and had added a few besides. But something in how Durzo said it, something about that comment coming from him, struck her to the core. She couldn't move. She couldn't even breathe. Finally, she said,
"I know if I'd had the chance for love that you had, I would have quit whoring. I would have done anything to hold on to that. I was born into this chamber pot of a life. You're the one who chose it."
"What's my daughter's name?"
"So that's it? You bring me here to remind me how many times I got fucked in this stinking hole? I remember. I remember. I whored so my baby sister wouldn't have to, and then you came along. You fucked me 5 times a week and told Vonda that you loved her. Got her pregnant. Left. I could have told her that much was a given. That part of the story so predictable it's not even worth repeating, is it? But you weren't just any John, no. You got her kidnapped, too. And then what? Did you go after her? No. You showed exactly how much you loved her, called their bluff, didn't you? You always were willing to gamble with other people's lives, weren't you, Durzo? You coward!"
Durzo's glass exploded against the keg behind her. He was trembling violently. He pointed a finger in her face.
"You. You don't have any right. You would have given it all up for love? Whore shit. Where's the man in your life now, Gwyn? You don't whore anymore, so there's nothing for a man to be jealous of, right? But there's still no man, is there? Do you want to know why you're the perfect whore? For the same reason there's no man. Because you don't have the capacity for love. You're a cunt. You suck everyone dry, and you make them pay you for the pleasure.
So don't give me that bleeding heart. I did it to save my sister, horseshit. It's always been power for you. Oh, sure, there are women who whore for money or for fame or because they don't have any other options. But then there are whores. You might not fuck anymore, Gwyn, but you always will be a whore. Now, what is her name?
He bit off each word like moldy bread.
Uli,
Guinevere said quietly.
Ulysandra. She lives with a nurse in the castle.
She looked at the beer she was holding in her hand. She didn't even remember filling it. Was this what Durzo reduced her to? A submissive little... She didn't even know. She felt like she'd been eviscerated, that if she looked down, she'd see ropes of her own intestines coiled around her feet. It took all of her strength to spit in the beer and set it on the counter with even a shadow of nonchalance.
"Well, it's tough to be a victim of circumstance," Durzo said.
His voice had that killing edge on it.
"You aren't...
You wouldn't kill your own child." Not even Durzo could do that. Could he?
"I won't have to," Durzo said. "They'll kill her for me."
He picked up the beer, smiled at Guinevere over the spit, and drank. He finished half the beer at a gulp and said,
"I'm leaving. It smells like old whore in here."
He poured the rest of his beer onto the floor and set the glass carefully on the bar. Kylar woke 2 hours before dawn and briefly wondered if death would be too high a price to pay for a full night's sleep. The correct answer, however, was unavoidable, so after a few minutes he dragged himself out of bed. He dressed quietly in the dark, reaching into his third drawer where his wet boy grays were folded, as always, and reaching into his ash jar to smear his features black. In the past 9 years, he'd learned to compensate for not having the talent. When Blint was in an optimistic mood, which was increasingly rare, he praised Kylar for it. He said that too many wet boys relied on their talent for everything, and that he kept his mundane talents honed for unpredictable situations. In the bitter business, unpredictable situations were the norm. "Besides," Blint said, "if there's almost no noise of a footstep to cover in the first place, you don't have to use as much of your talent to muffle it." Sometimes Kylar's adaptability showed itself in more spectacular ways, but mostly it was in these little things, like putting his grays in the same dresser, the same way, every time he washed them. At least he hoped it was his adaptability and not Blint's mania for organization infecting him. Seriously, what was it with the man's locking locks 3 times and spinning knives and the garlic and the night angel this and night angel that? The window opened silently, and Kylar crept across the roof. Years of practice taught him where he could walk and where he had to crawl to be unheard by those below. He slipped over the edge of the house, dropped onto the flagstones in the courtyard, and vaulted off a rock to grab the edge of the wall. He raised himself to peek over the edge, saw no one, pulled himself over the wall, and then moved stealthily up the street. He probably could have just walked. Sneaking wasn't really necessary once he got out of sight of the Drake's home and until he got within sight of the herbiary. But it was a bad habit to get into. A job is a job. It isn't done till it's done. Another of Blint's pearls. There. Thanks. Tonight, it wasn't just Blint's ingrained discipline that kept him creeping from shadows to shadow, making the 2-mile walk in the herbiary take almost an hour. Tonight, Jarl's words kept going through his head.
"You have enemies. You have enemies.
Maybe it was time he moved out of the Drake's house, for their safety. He was 20 years old, and though, of course, he didn't have the income of a noble, Blint was more than generous with his wages. In fact, Blint didn't really care about money. He didn't spend much on himself, aside from the infrequent binges on alcohol and rent girls. He did buy the best equipment and ingredients for poisons, but what he bought, he kept forever. With what he made for each kill and the frequency with which he took jobs, Blint had to be wealthy. Probably obscenely wealthy. Not that Kylar cared. He'd adopted much of Blint's attitude. He gave Count Drake a portion of his wages for Eline, and still had plenty left over. He kept some in coins and jewels, and split the rest between investments Mama Kay and Logan made for him. It meant nothing to him, because money couldn't buy him anything. His cover as a poor country noble, and his real work as a journeyman wet boy, kept him from living a lifestyle that would attract attention. So, even if he had wanted to spend his money, he couldn't afford to. He could move out, though. Rent a small home further south on the east side, at the edges of one of the less fashionable neighborhoods. Blint had told him that if you bought the cheapest house in a neighborhood, no matter how expensive the neighborhood, you were invisible. Even if your neighbors noticed you, they'd take pains not to notice you. Then, Kylar was at the shop. The Sakage had long had an arrangement with herbalists in the city. The herbalists made sure they kept certain plants on hand that weren't strictly legal, and the Sakage made sure that the herbalists' shops were never burglarized. The Crown knew about it, but was powerless to stop it. Goodman Aileyep's herbiary was frequented by rich merchants and the nobility, so he had refused to keep illicit herbs openly in his shop, fearing that such defiance in the very face of authority might not be ignored. He'd been able to refuse the Sakage, but no one refused Master Blint. Goodman Aileyep supplied Durzo with the rarest herbs. In return, Master Blint made sure no one else in the Sakage so much as went near his shop. It fell to Kylar to gather the necessaries and drop off the money, which he was doing tonight. The benefit to running these errands wasn't only that he learned the trade or that he established relationships with the people who would supply him in the future, it was also that he could build his own collection. An elaborate collection like Master Blint's took years and thousands or even tens of thousands of gunders to build. The bad part was losing sleep. It didn't do for a young noble to sleep until noon unless he'd been out, carousing with his friends. So, even though he wouldn't get home until almost dawn, Kylar would have to wake with the sun. He grumbled silently, remembering a time when sneaking through the streets of Cenaria at night had been fun. The back door of his shop, as always, was locked. Goodman Aileyep kept good locks on his doors, too. Though he'd never met him, they only wrote notes, Kylar felt he knew Goodman Aileyep, and the man was a strange one. With Durzo Blint's protection in the Sakage, the man could have safely left his doors wide open. No one in the city would dare steal from him. But, as Blint said, a man's greatest treasures are his illusions. For all the man claimed to hate teaching, he seemed to have an aphorism for every occasion. Kylar selected the proper pick and anchor from the kit on the inside of his belt, and he knelt in front of the door and started working. He sighed. It was a new lock, and from Master Prods, the best locksmith in the city. New locks, even if they weren't high quality, always tended to be tighter, and if losing an anchor wasn't the end of his world, it was still irritating to break one. Kylar raked the pick over the pins. 4 pins, 2 of them a little loose. That meant it was the work of one of Prod's journeymen and not the master himself. In 10 seconds, he turned the anchor, bending it, and the door opened. Kylar cursed, silently. He'd have to get another new anchor. Then tucked his tools away. Someday he was going to have to commission a set of Mystareel picks and anchors like Master Blint had, or at least one anchor. Mystareel would flex, but never break. But it was more expensive by weight than diamonds. Goodman Aeliep's claim that his business was an herbiary wasn't an idle boast. It had three rooms. The large, comfortable shop with labeled glass jars for the display of herbs, a tiny office, and the herbiary in which Kylar stood. The little room was humid, and the wet, fecund odors were almost overwhelming. Checking on the progress of some fungi, Kylar was pleased. Several lethal mushrooms would be ready within a week. Mushrooms were one kind of plant Goodman Aeliep could grow with impunity in his shop. Lethal varieties were indistinguishable from edible mushrooms to anyone except trained herbalists and, of course, trained poisoners. Treading carefully so he didn't step on any of the boards that creaked, Kylar moved through the rest of the herbiary, judging the plants with a practiced eye. Kylar lifted the third plant box in the second row and saw six bundles carefully packed in individual lambskin pouches. He lifted them out and checked that each was what he had ordered. Four bundles for Master Blint, and two for himself. Kylar put the herbs in the pack, secured flush against his back under his cloak, and put the purse with Aeliep's money into the little space. He set the planter back in position. Then, something felt wrong. In the blink of an eye, Kylar drew two short swords. But he didn't move a step. The feeling of wrongness continued. Not something wrong of itself, but just something here, and now, and close. There was no sound. There was no attack, just a slight pressure, as of the softest possible touch of a finger. Kylar focused on the sensation, even as his eyes scanned the shop and his ears strained to hear the slightest sound. It was like a touch, but it was pressing past him toward the lock on the back door clicked home. He was trapped.